All right. Let's give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Brian from the Friends of Bill W. Home Group.
Hi, I'm Brian Malcolic. First, I want to thank God for getting me here. I want to thank God for getting all of you in. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for being here. And thank you guys for asking me to come and share. Thank you, Gabby, for getting me involved. You know, I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, I recently moved here. I moved here from New Jersey a year ago, and I came here, and I was going to the meeting up at Friends of Bill W. every Thursday. And my friend Mike over there, a couple weeks ago, he said to me, maybe 2 months ago, he said to me, he said, you got a home group? No. I says, I'm looking around. He says, okay. And I left him, and in the meeting, I shared about how I was really glad that, you know, that somebody actually, even though everybody has been very warm to me, I got no issues, everybody has just been so nice and everything. And when Mike said that, it kind of made me say, you know what? I'm homeless. I'm homeless, you know, and that's what I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't have a home group, I'm homeless. And I joined the Friends of Bill W. group, and I'm glad that I did. You know, it's been I've enjoyed being here, and I say publicly that thank you guys for showing me, you know, all of you. A lot of you I've met coming to meet since I've been here. You know, my friend Rick over there talks to me a lot. You know, and I really enjoy it. I felt very warm and welcome. And Alcoholics Anonymous did just what it said it would do. You know, we were sharing last night. We were on step five, and we were talking about how if I come to meetings or if I'm in the program and I don't engage with you guys, it's not going to work. I have to engage with other alcoholics in order for this to work. You know, I can sit and come in here and sit and just don't talk and don't do nothing. This program doesn't work like that, you know, by osmosis. You know, you have to do something in order for this to work. But I'm an alcoholic. I grew up in the South. I grew up in Atlanta. And growing up as a kid, mother and father, you know, they drank, you know. And I remember at an early age watching them drink, and they would get drunk, and then they would just change into these other people, and they were get all silly and giddy and whatnot, and next thing you know, they were fighting and they were arguing and they were playing cards, all kinds of nonsense. And I would always say to myself, I'm never gonna be like this, you know, and believe me, I was worse. I remember at an early age, my father and mother separated. I think I was about 12 or 13, and when my father and mother separated, I immediately became the man of the house, you know, because I was the oldest, and now it's my house. So my mother, you know, she worked and she did the best she could, and I started, you know, hanging out with fellas, you know, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but also at that time, I remember getting introduced to that stuff that looks like oregano. You know, and getting that stuff to look like oregano, and we started, you know, smoking it and, you know, doing little teenage things, never getting into real trouble. You know, I remember also at that time I started trusting, you know, in Atlanta at that time, the guy would say, well, okay, give me your $5 and go over there and look up under the rock. What you want is under the rock. You understand? Now I give this guy my $5 over here, but now I'm going over here because I'm trusting this guy going to have what he has. And it was there, you know. Still growing up a teenager, I remember my mother started dating, and any guy that she dated, I didn't like, because I felt as though he was trying to like take my place, because this is my house, and I don't need none of this going on. And so I was not receptive to it. And these guys tried to buy my friendship and whatnot, and I wouldn't allow it. You understand? I had to build that exterior up. To whereas I couldn't let you get him, you know, break that. You know, I had to keep you back over there, and I stayed over here. And I did that. I started working at 16 and started working at little restaurants in Atlanta. There was a place in Atlanta called Underground Atlanta. It was like a city underground, and I was bussing tables, washing dishes, and all this kind of stuff. And now I picked up another habit. I started stealing. I was still everything that wasn't nailed down, and I would steal this stuff, and I needed, and I would steal it, not for just for me to have, but I would steal it to give to you because I needed you to know how good of a guy I was. And so I started people pleasing, you know, and that's what I did, you know. And some of the stuff that I was stealing was just ridiculous. It made no sense, you know, why I was stealing this nonsense. So now I'm still doing, working underground at this restaurant, and I started still growing up, still having a good time, and now I decided to drop out of school because I need to just work and make money. And I dropped out of school, and next thing you know, the restaurant fired me or whatever, and now I'm not doing anything. And I had an aunt that lived in New Jersey, and she happened to be down on vacation, and she said to me, she says, you know, you really need to come to New Jersey and live with me because right now you're not doing anything with your life. And I says, yeah, okay. I says, I got no problem with that. You'd have to ask my mother. So she went and asked my mother if she could take me to Jersey. My mother said, take him. You know, and that's just what happened. You understand? But let me back up for a moment. As a kid, I always wanted to live up north. There was something about living up north to me just was always on my mind. I dreamed about living up north because it seemed to me like you guys were a lot slicker and a lot smoother. And I felt as though Georgia was holding me back. So it was always in the back of my mind. So now I get the opportunity to go to Jersey and live with my aunt. I go to Jersey, and we're living in Jersey, a town called Union, New Jersey, right outside of Newark. And I started going to high school there, you know. They put me in the 11th grade. I finished the 11th grade there. And now the guys in the neighborhood, they want to introduce me to the neighborhood, you know. And what they would do is they'd come in, and I'd walk, we go out at night, and we get a quart of old English beer, maybe two quarts. And then we would get some more oregano-like stuff, and we would smoke this mess, and we would walk up and down the street all night long, just walk from one end, go back up, just walk back down, and just typical teenagers crap. And that's what we did. And so that went on, and never really get into the serious consequences of anything. Nothing happened. And the following year, I graduated from the high school, and upon graduation, you know, I'm going to graduate. I went into the Army. I felt as though if I went into the Army, I could get a jump start. I called it. You know, I can get myself together. I'd save some money. I can do some things. And that's what I did. You know, and I told you I was a dreamer. I go into the military. Now, normal people would probably go into the military and think about a career. Well, I went in for adventure. You understand? I was in air defense artillery, and I was in. I dealt with missiles, and that's what I went in, you know. And not thinking about my future, what I was going to do after I got out of the military, but you know, I just did it for adventure. I went in. I went down to Fort Bliss, Texas, and down in Fort Bliss, Texas it's right in El Paso, and El Paso, Texas borders Juarez, Mexico. Well. We're down in El Paso, and I'm in school. We were in basic, and somehow, no, these guys managed to get some beer in basic. And I had a can of beer. The other guys had a can of beer, but somebody got caught. And so what happened was, the following day, they told on everybody that had a can of beer, and I was one of the ones. And what we had to do was take a room such as this, take everything outside, scrub the walls, scrub the floors, bring it back inside, and go to bed. Well, the rest of the platoon wanted to kill us because of the mess we had created. So I managed to get through basic, and now I'm going to school in Texas, same school, same fort. And in school, in the barracks, they had beer machines. For 50 cents a can, you could get you an Olympic beer. I lived at the machine, you understand? This is where things started to happen. So I was in school in El Paso, and now the guys decided to go to Juarez, Mexico one weekend, and we're going to Juarez, Mexico. I'd never been to Mexico, and so we're gonna go over there, and we're gonna see what Mexico is like. We'd heard things, and we go to Mexico. Prior to going to Mexico, the guys said, well, listen, let's get something to drink. And we got a hotel room in El Paso, and we're gonna walk across the bridge, So they decided to get a half a gallon of Tanqueray gin. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, we went to Mexico. I don't remember Mexico. I don't know what happened in Mexico. All I know is the next day the guy said to me, oh, you had a great time, you had a great time. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? I said, no, you had a good time. Trust me, you had a good time. And little did I know that that was the first blackout of a whole lot of blackouts to come. I came back to from Texas. My next permanent duty station was a Homestead Air Force Base, and it was attached. We were a missile unit. And we were attached to an Air Force base in right at Homestead Air Force, Homestead, Florida, which is about 30 minutes outside of Miami. So now we're down there, and now we're talking in the 70s. You know, this is 76. I'm down there, and this is when the stuff like oregano. It was coming in Miami like you wouldn't believe. We could buy ShopRite bags or grocery bags full of it for like $20. Now we're trying to soldier. Now we're smoking this oregano-like stuff, and we're drinking and playing cards. Just having a ball out in Florida. And that's what we did. Stayed down there, had a great time. Now it's time to move again, and I had to go overseas. Now I'm going overseas, and still, you know, just get moving along. I'm going overseas, and now I had to go to Korea. And I went to Korea in 1978, and over there, the dreamer that I am just really got out of control, because now I'm over there. I don't know if you're familiar with Black Marketeer. And what that is that I'm selling American goods on the Korean market. I made a lot of money at it, you understand? I'm loan sharking. And I would loan shark and maybe loan you 20 and you pay me back 30. You know what I'm saying? I'm just out of control now. And then on top of all that, we're drinking Korean liquor, and we're taking Korean drugs, because over there you get the girls to go into the drugstore and get you pure drugs, like pure codeine. Our idea of having a good time was like drinking pure codeines and taking these pills, and we would actually sit and nod and scratch. That was a good time, you understand? We did that. That's how insane things were, you know? So now I'm overseas, and this is 1979, and in March of 1979, I had been out drinking and doing all this foolishness, and air defense, we were set up overseas on top of mountains. That's where the units were. So I'm up there, my crew, I'm in charge of people now. Now I got responsibility, I'm in charge of crew. So I got a four-man crew, and my crew, we're in an office, and I'm asleep, and the crew is asleep. So now the officer walked in and caught us all sleeping. Now I'm in charge, so you know who's going, I'm going to get in trouble. So now I'm like, oh my God, I know I'm finna get court-martialed, I don't know what they're going to do. So with that happens, they said, come off the mountain, we want to see you down below. So I'm getting ready to go see what kind of trouble I'm in, and the Red Cross people said, no, we need to see you now in the city. I'm like, what? And now you see the Red Cross people, you know that something probably tragic has happened. And what happened was my mother had died in Atlanta, and I had to immediately fly back to the States. And I flew back to Atlanta, and poor Ron, he just lost his mother. Now I'm in Atlanta, my grandmother, my brother, you know, other family members, everybody's down there feeling sorry for me. I'm totally out of control. I'm just drinking like a fish. I'm just terrible. The whole week I'm there, you know, my grandmother wanted me to do certain things as far as the funeral is concerned, and I wouldn't do it, you know, and I'm just really out of control. The alcohol has just got me all in sorts. So now I take care of my mother's arrangements and make sure she's put away properly and all that stuff. And now it's time to go back. So now I come to Jersey, and I stay in Jersey 2 weeks before I was trying to go back overseas. And to show you the kind of fool that I am, if anybody's ever been around the military, you know that on military bases, they have what they call 3.2 beer. So rather than take my clothing back overseas, I felt as though the guys needed some real beer. So I took Löwenbräu overseas in my luggage, you understand? That's how insane I was. So now I go back overseas. I got 6 months left on my tour before I was due to get out of the Army. Now, if When I got out of the Army in 79, if you'd have came to me and said, well, why'd you get out of the Army? I says, oh, you know, the Army, they forgot to ask me to reenlist. The Army didn't forget. They didn't want me to reenlist. You understand? They saw the kind of soldier that I was becoming. So I got on out, and I came back to Jersey, and I started going to college in Cranford, New Jersey, which is a town over from the town in which I lived in. And I also got a job at a grocery store warehouse, and I was in the produce department, and I was working from 6:30 in the evening to 2:30 in the morning, and we were selecting produce to put on the trucks and stuff like that. And I did that. But now I met this guy. Here it is, I'm an ex-Army guy, and this guy's an ex-Marine. And this guy, he lived not far from the place, and he had this amazing thing that was happening. We would leave after we got work at 2:30 in the morning. We would get two six-packs of beer, a pint of Christian Brothers brandy. We'd get some oregano-type stuff. But this guy had a cat that could actually walk around the top of the door sill. And we would sit there and watch this cat walk around the top of the door sill, smoking and drinking all night long. Well, you know, college wasn't going to last. College was the first thing I let go. Him and I sitting in there telling war stories. He had been in the war, and neither had I. This is kind of insane things that we were doing. So now college is gone. Now I'm working. And now the job, me and the supervisor had an altercation. So, I'm a smart guy. So, you know, rather than let this job fire me, why don't I just resign? So I up and resigned from the job. You understand? Now I'm not doing anything. And now, like I said, my aunt was the one that, with all this has happened, my aunt, I'm living in her house, and no job, no college, no nothing. And one particular morning back in 1981, her husband said to me, so, well, listen, come and take a ride with me. And I says, okay. So he took me to his job, and he got his boss to give me a job. Well, I tell you, that was the best thing that probably ever happened to me, because I was fortunate enough to retire off that job about 6 years ago. I had 37 years of service, you understand? On that job, I embarrassed my uncle in that job, because my motto was, if you want it, you better lock it up. Because if I get my hands on it, it's leaving here. I stole everything that wasn't nailed down. That's what I did. And so I'm stealing on the job, I'm stealing gas, I'm stealing product, I'm stealing everything. And so I got caught, and the boss was going to terminate me, and my uncle talked to him, and they suspended me or whatever. So now I got another brilliant idea. Well, back when I was in high school, there was this girl I used to go out with. Why don't I marry this girl? I could save some money. I could get sober, I get straightened out. And, you know, I could get on about life. So I managed to talk her into marrying me and all this nonsense, and she agreed. And the wedding was planned. My friend came in from Philly, my best man. And every day when the liquor store opened up, because the liquor store was open at 10 o'clock. And so every day when the liquor store opened for that week, I would go to the liquor store. I get a half a gallon of this Bottle King Scotch. It was the store brand Scotch. And him and I would start drinking this stuff. And we did it starting on a Monday, and about Thursday, she had had enough. Now, we ain't got married yet, but now she had enough. So now she gonna straight me out. So what happened was she confronted me about my drinking. And I say this, and I mean this wholeheartedly. Hitting a woman is one of the lowest things you can do, and I know that. And I did it. Her and I got into a physical fight, and I got the best of her. And her mother told her don't get married. And so she said, no, we get married. So we went ahead and got married. And believe me, the first year we were married, I'm drinking like crazy. The blackouts are happening. I'm getting in more trouble, and the trouble was starting to increase. And so now she come again. Now, I thought she learned the first time, but she confronted me about my drinking again this time. Well, she came again, and this time she came prepared. She brought a knife to the fight. I have a scar on my arm to show that she was for real. That girl almost cut my arm off, you understand? And from that day to this day, I have never, ever put my hands on a woman. And I suggest nobody do that, you know? Soon after, she asked me to leave, and we had a son born, and prior to me leaving, she would go to church, and my son would wake me up sometime, and he'd be covered in Vaseline, syrup, flour, whatever he got into. I wasn't responsible. And so she asked me to leave, and so now I agreed to leave, and I went to now I had another aunt. My aunt was her sister. So they had a house, and they put me in the other house. And now I'm living in the attic of this house with a peak in it. Excuse me. And in order to go to the bathroom, I had to go down the stairs, out the front door, around the house, into the basement to go to the bathroom. And I lived like that for almost 2 years, like there was nothing wrong with that. Like normal people live like that. Blackouts coming more frequently, you know. And now I met another girl, and her mother had left her and her sister house, and I call myself moving in with her, and blackouts still coming, and I'm tearing up cars. I'm doing all kinds of stuff, you know, and move in with her, and she had two children, and I tormented her children. I would drive them crazy, you know, and but for the grace of God, those kids are all right, and they're still in my life today, you understand, and, you know, I really aggravated them because I was that kind of a drunk. I get on your nerves. You don't want me around, you know. And so she was pregnant, and we're living together, and so I'm still doing my thing. And like I said, I hit and run cars, and I remember one time I hit and run a car right in Newark, and it was in Union. Sorry, I hit and run this car, and the guy came to the house. And he knocked on the door and said, where's Brian at? He says, Brian, this guy wants to see you. And the guy said that I hit and run his car. I said, nah, man, I ain't hit and run your car. But he said, Brian, you hit and run my car. I'm like, nah, man, I do it. You hit and run my car, Brian. I sat there and I watched you do it. And now I got to call the insurance company, and they settled. They took care of his car and everything. But those were the kind of insane acts in which I was doing in a blackout because... I'm a blackout drinker, you understand? When I blackout, when I drink, I don't know what might happen. So back in June of 1989, I had been to a retirement party, and at this party, you know, they don't serve alcohol at this time. They had stopped serving alcohol at these parties. It was just beer, it was just drinks, regular sodas or whatever. But anyway, after the party, I picked up another habit. I used to hang out with these old guys because these old guys, here it is, I'm a young guy, these old guys, you hang around them, they give you some wisdom. So I hang around, they tell you this wisdom, these stories and whatnot. That's who I drank with. So I would sit in this car and drink with these guys. These guys could be my father. That's how old these guys were. And that's what I would do. So now we drink a couple, I think we drink a fifth of Seagram's gin or whatever. But the old guys are also smart. They're going to have sense to go home. Not me. I got to go to the bar. Because now I go to the bar. And now I'm in the bar. I told you I'm a blackout drinker. I'm in the bar. And now, this guy said I said something to his girl. Well, I said, well, him and I had words. And I said, well, you know what? I'm just going to go home and get my gun. And I'm going to shoot this guy. You understand? So I go get in the car. And I head home to go get the gun. And now... brilliant guy like me says, you know, a real man will fight this guy hand to hand. That's how crazy I was, right? Mm-hmm. A real man will fight this guy hand to hand. So I turn around, come back to the bar. I can't find a parking place for the car. The only place I find to park the car was the sidewalk. On the sidewalk by the bar between a pole and a fence. So I drove the car on the sidewalk. I get out the car, I squeeze to get out of the car, and I'm going in the bar and I'm gonna fight this guy. So now I go inside And another guy tapped me on my shoulder and said, "Hey, fool, you know where you park your car?" I said, "It's outside." He said, "No, idiot, come move your car." So I'd like to think that's that moment of clarity that they talk about in this program. Because I went and got in the car, and I went home. I went home. Like I said, she was pregnant. And then this was a Friday night. That Saturday morning, she woke me up, and she said, "You see my car?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's outside." She said, "No, you need to come and look at my car." From the front fenders to the back fenders, both sides of that car, girl's car was ruined. I screwed up both sides of the car, right? And so at that same time, I happened to be working a little part-time job, you know, the same company I work for now, doing the same kind of thing. And I went to work that night, and I was in the parking lot, and I just started crying. I just said, "You know what, God? I have absolutely lost my mind. I am crazy. I can't take it anymore." And that was on a Saturday night. And what happened was that Monday, I hadn't drank, but that Monday, she said to me, "You know, you gotta get some help." I said, "Yeah, I gotta get some help." So I went looking at different rehabs, and one of the rehabs said to me, "So we'll go home and sit by the phone." Another rehab said, "Well, we need to evaluate you." I don't need to evaluate, I need help. And so I went, and I went and cleared up with the job. I told my job I had a drinking problem. So the guy said, "Listen, go get yourself straightened out and come on back." And that Monday, they didn't call until Wednesday morning, I think they called. And I went to a place in Jersey called Fair Oaks. And in Fair Oaks, I went in there, and the first time I sat down amongst people like yourselves and said, "My name was Brian and I'm an alcoholic," the weight that was lifted was unbelievable. You know, I just felt so much better just to say it, finally say what I was. You know, and I sat down and I started learning about the disease of alcoholism. I started learning that. I was crazy. I wasn't that crazy. Alcohol took my morality away from me. It took my reasoning skills away from me. It took me away from me, you know. And I started learning everything about the disease of alcoholism. And I stayed in there just, you know, listening and learning and trying to get better. And it was a 28-day program. Well, at the end of 28 days, they decided that I needed to stay another week. I mean, I need to stay another week. I don't understand. Why would I need to stay another week? And the reason why they said I need to stay another week was because they wanted to do an intervention on her. But me being still trying to be in control, you know, I don't need you to do an intervention on her. You just talk to me. Don't worry about her. I got her. Don't talk to her. And they said, no, you're not going to dictate your treatment or whatever. So I stayed in there, like I said, for the extra week. And I can honestly tell you, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I started learning that, I learned in that week that my best advice got me a seat in here. I need to listen to you guys and listen to God's voice, you understand, in order to get better, because I don't know everything, you know, and thank God I don't, you understand. And so I stayed in there and I came out and I started going to meetings and I started going to these meetings. And I went into a meeting of mine when I got out of rehab, and me and another friend of mine, him and I was in rehab together, and him and I would go pick each other up. We'd go to meetings every night for the first 90 days. Well, in those 90 days, what happened was I had been at work and something happened. And my friend Henry picked me up, and Henry and I, we do like we always do. When we come from the meeting, we'll sit either in front of his house or in front of my house, and we would talk about the program and talk about whatever we would talk about, how our day went or whatever. And Henry and I were sitting there talking, and I said to Henry, I said, "You know, man," I said, "today was a tough day, man." I says, "You just don't know, man." I said, "Henry, I was gonna go out today, man, and I was gonna take you with me." Henry cursed me out and said, "You ain't taking me no GD where." I said, "What?" You know, and I tell you, and that happened in my first year, 1989, in the program, and from that time, until I'm standing right now, I have never ever thought about leaving the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I'm saying? I stayed the course. I trusted in the process. A lot of things have happened. You understand? I met a guy. This guy told me that he was going to teach me how, he was going to teach me the scientific way of how to stay sober. And you know how that is? If you don't drink today, you can't get drunk today. Wow. That's amazing. I couldn't figure, I never thought of that. I couldn't figure that out. And so, guys like that, you understand, kept taking me to meetings. I would just latch on. I got a sponsor, and he would drag me all over the place. He got me involved with Matt Talbot retreat groups. I would go on Matt Talbot retreat groups. I was doing whatever I had to do, you understand? I shared it at my home group a couple weeks ago about how in step one, it says that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. I can admit that I was powerless over alcohol, but I wasn't unmanageable because I didn't have a bank account. I had a car that if I turned the ignition and Anthony had to hold the screwdriver in the carburetor, that's how we started the car. I had nothing to show for anything, but I wasn't unmanageable. That was the farthest thing from the truth. I was so unmanageable, it was unbelievable. And so I just stayed with the process, and I kept going to meetings, and I kept trying to get better, you know, and I just kept hanging on, you understand? Like I said, I hung around with older guys, and so now I come into the program, and I started hanging around more older guys, guys that had been around, you understand, that knew how to do this thing. I'm talking about, and at that time, I was around guys, and I'm sorry to say this, these guys were pretty rude because they tell you to sit your A down in that chair. If we want to know how to get drunk, we'll ask you. And if we don't ask you, obviously we don't want to know. And I'm like, who do you think you're talking to? And I would sit down in the chair and I'll listen to what they had to say. And they taught me how to stay sober one day at a time, you know. And like I said, I stayed in the process. I trusted the process, and I still do today, you understand? A lot of things have happened between the kids being born, watching the kids grow up, you know. I watched the kids were constantly growing up. I started getting better. I started getting involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a booker in my group. I went to a church. I was a member of a church, you understand? And I was an officer in my trust church. Now remember, I'm the guy that steals a lot. But now I'm a trustee. I was a trustee of my church in Jersey, where I was a chairman of the trustee board. So I was in charge of writing checks, signing checks, credit cards, all of it. And I never took any of the church's money. I never stole from the church. And that's only because of God's grace and mercy and you guys teaching me how to be a responsible person. My sons, like I said, they grew up. They started growing up. They started getting better. I was still doing, you know, working and going on commitments. I was going on Matt Talbot. I was going to conventions. I was taking part of everything that Alcoholics Anonymous had. You understand? And I was really enjoying life. You know, I married a woman at my church. Now, remember, I'm crazy now. I married this girl at my church, and she was a good one. But we weren't right. It didn't fit. And what happened was, we got divorced, and we stayed divorced maybe 2 years. Now, the brainiac that I am, if it didn't work the first time, why would I go back and marry this girl again? And I turned around and married her again, and this time it didn't even last a year because it didn't work, you understand? And those are the kind of things that I had to go through to get to where I am today. I like I said, I got divorced, and now I'm living on my own, and I met a girl in this program back in 2011. And I met her, and she would go to the same home group we went to. And then in 2012, we started talking. We started going on dates, and we started talking. And I think in 2013, we got married. And we got married, and we would travel. I had a life like you would not believe. You understand, we were doing some things. She was so smart. And our goal was that we were going to move to Virginia. That was the plan. Yolanda and I were going to move to Virginia. because here in Virginia, they got bingo. She loves bingo. She could play bingo all day long, and she loved bingo. We would go to Vegas. We go to Connecticut. She loved bingo, and she was good at it. And so that was our dream to move to Virginia. And so back in 2022, Super Bowl Sunday, as a matter of fact, I was going to pick up our daughter, and she called me. She says, Brian, you need to come home. I'm like, what's going on? She says, no, come home. I don't feel well. And by the time I was only 10 minutes away. By the time I got to the house, Yolanda was collapsing the floor. And Yolanda being collapsed in the floor, we called EMT. I was trying to do CPR and trying, but she was just there. And so finally EMT got there and they took over. They took her outside and they worked on it. At first they worked on her in the house. Then they took her out to the truck. They worked on it again. Then they took her to the hospital. And the hospital was maybe 5 minutes from the house. And Yolanda died. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, Yolanda was the best thing to happen to me. I've been married, the third time I've been married, but Yolanda was the one. You know, I miss her, and I think about her. I just hate that it didn't happen, but who's to know? You know, God, you know, I don't question God, you know, and I just keep moving on. So, like I said, our dream was to move here, so I was going to further the dream, and I came on to Virginia, and I came on down because we were going to live here. My brother and his wife moved here. The four of us was going to be like retirees, and we were going to live here. And so I'm here. You know, Yolanda's spirit is with me every day, and I pray, you know, and I'm just trying to do the best I can. And that's why it was so important to come and get a home group down here to get plugged in, you understand? I still go to meetings on Zoom and whatnot. But I needed to be able to go into a physical meeting. And I thank you, Mike, for encouraging me, you know, to join a home group to get plugged in, because I need to be plugged in. I was just going there every Thursday, you know, soaking up what I could soak up and leaving. But I needed to be plugged in so people like Gabby could ask me to come out and speak. Thank you, Gabrielle, for asking me to come out and speak, because this is what I need to do, because you guys need to know who I am, you understand, and what I am. And I'm an alcoholic. And if I wasn't an alcoholic, I would do until one came along, you understand? Because that's just the way I live. You know, my life has been a life that I've had a wonderful life, all because of this program, you understand? Because of all the things that have happened through it all, you understand? I've stayed the course, you understand? I don't allow people to come to me and talk to me in a negative way about Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe Alcoholics Anonymous may not work for you. It's working for me just fine. You understand? It's working for me fine. I got no questions. No, you know, I enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a business meeting last week at our home group, and I was telling Brendan after the meeting, this is the nicest business meeting I've ever been in. You understand? But I know that's not going to last long. But I really enjoyed it. You know what I'm saying? You know, but, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, excuse me. I love this program. You understand? You know, this program, like I said, it gave me a life. I had no life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You understand? I just existed. Now I actually have a life. You know, the company, like I said, I work for a company. And the company I work for, we do golf events. Any major golf event that you see on television, I'm probably there. Because we handle logistics for the PGA and the USGA. And now we're doing Live, and we're doing Formula One. We do a lot of events, big events that we do. And I travel a lot. I really travel a lot, too much to be exact, you know. But I enjoy it. It gives me something to do, you know. And I enjoy travel. That was something, like I said, I was a dreamer. I always wanted to travel, and now I travel a lot, and I enjoy it. You know, this program, if I'd have made a list of the things that I wanted to happen, I really would have shortchanged myself, because I've gotten so much more back. I got me back. Because I always knew inside of me that I was a decent guy. But alcohol never allowed the decent guy to come out. Alcohol just stepped in and said, I'm running this, and you just gonna do it. Because I was a slave to alcohol and drugs, you understand? Alcohol told me when to go to work, when to steal from you, when to just do something ridiculous, and that's what I did, you understand? But now, doing the right thing, I like doing the right thing. I like being honest, you understand? I like being trustworthy. I like being accountable. And all these are qualities in which you guys have given, showed me how to obtain, how to do the right thing, you understand? And I enjoy it, you understand? My life, like I said, is just unbelievable, you know? I came in here with a monkey on my back. If I go back out there this time, there's no doubt in my mind the whole circus is coming this time. You understand? You know, and I don't want no parts of that. I want no parts of that. So what I do is I go to meetings, I trust in the process, and I just keep it moving. You understand? You know, I was looking forward to the conference. You know, because of COVID, we weren't allowed to go to Detroit, but now I'm looking to go to Vancouver. But, you know, Vancouver, you know, from we're finding out the logistics of it is small, but and all the hotels are sold out. So we're trying to get a hotel. My brother and I, because my brother, like I said, he's one of us, and he just moved here from Seattle. So he knows there. He knows there. He's been to Vancouver quite a few times. So we're trying to get a place for a hotel someplace. And the closest place we can find now is like an hour away from the event. And I think they wanted $350 a night for a hotel. And I'm like, oh my God. So he's going to keep working on it because, excuse me, I really want to be there. I was at Toronto, I was at Atlanta, I was in San Antonio, you know, and I enjoy the World Convention. It is unbelievable. If you've never been, I suggest you go. It is unbelievable to have that many alcoholics in the room. You know, we were in Toronto, and that happened to be the largest convention they'd ever had there, the Alcoholics Anonymous Convention, you understand? You know, we were in Atlanta, and that was another large convention, and they said without no incidents. You know what I'm saying? To have these conventions and not have no incidents, you understand? That's us. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous. We take care of each other. And that's another thing that has happened, you understand? You know, we do take care of each other. I've met people from all over the world, you understand? You know, and I stay in contact with them. You know, the Zoom platform, because of the COVID, I've had to get involved with go to a lot of Zoom meetings, especially since I moved here, you understand? And I met so many wonderful people, you understand? I was just at a conference last year in September. They call it Monitor to Monitor. I was out in California, you understand? And it was bringing the Zoom people together, you know? It was outstanding out in LA. You know, like I said, if Alcoholics Anonymous saves lives, it saved my life. It'll save any, if it can save my life, it'll save anybody's life, you understand? You know, doing 12-step work, I think, oh yeah, let me see, this is what, let me read this. I was looking at this earlier, and, through experience with 12-step work, I came to understand the rewards of giving that demands nothing in return. Just think about that. You know, just doing what we do, you know, helping another sick and suffering alcoholic, you understand, and not actually looking for nothing in return. Because in order to keep this, I got to give it away. It does me no good just for me to sit on what I have. I have to give it to you in order for me to get better. And I do. I encourage people, you understand, people that are new, you understand, I run into, you understand, I encourage them, you understand, and stay with it. Don't trust the process, because that's what I had to do. I had to trust the process, you understand. I had to go with my friends on 12-step calls. I had to reach out and try and, you know, encourage people. I've had sponsees that went out, and thank God that I have a sponsor. I had the same sponsor for over 32 years. And when I had to sponsor this guy and he went out, it messed me up. And my sponsor explained to me that sometimes that's gonna happen. That's not your fault. You know, you did what you were supposed to do. You were where you were supposed to be. You know, and that was early on I learned that, you understand, of course I want everybody to get this thing, but everybody's not gonna get it. And I understand that, I accept that now. You understand, and I learned all these things. You know, anything that I say up here is of my opinion and my opinion alone. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I need Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous don't need me. I need it. You understand? You know, they say Alcoholics Anonymous is a copycat program, but just make sure you're following the right cat. You know, and that's what I do. You know, I try and stay in the process. I do whatever is necessary. You understand? And I just stay plugged in. You know, I can honestly say to you that in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no retirement program, there's no pension, there's no vacation, and you don't get to take days off. I'm sorry if I let, you know, the air out of somebody's balloon, but that's just how it is. I don't get to not say I'm not an alcoholic. Every day I have to say that I am an alcoholic, and I have to do this thing every day, one day at a time, you understand? And sometimes I've had to break it down to 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time, whatever it takes to get through. You understand? And sometimes I just pray to God, and just God just help me to hold on. And that's all I pray for. Now I pray to God, you know, just let me just take care, be in a position to take care of myself, be in a position to continue to go to meetings, continue to talk to other recovering people, you understand? You know, just continue to do what I'm doing, you understand? Because I don't want to go back. You know, I love where I'm at. And I'll say this in closing, you know, there's these three guys that went into a bar. I'll use for an example. Don't take this to heart. Like my friend Mike over there, you know. Mike goes into the bar. Mike orders a drink. Fly flies into Mike's drink. Nice guy like Mike. Mike says to the bartender, Fly flew in my drink. And so the bartender comes over, dumps the drink, give Mike a new drink. Mike a new drink. Mike drinks it. Then I got my friend Rick over there, and Rick in the bar, Rick orders a drink, Fly flies into his drink. Rick asks the bartender, you got a straw? Bartender hands Rick a straw. He takes the straw, flicks the fly out, drinks the drink. But now you got the guy like me. I'm in the bar, fly into my drink. I call the bartender over. To the bartender, do you have any tweezers? He says, what, tweezers? I said, yeah, tweezers. He gives me a set of tweezers. I grab the fly, and I tell the fly, spit it out, because I want all of mine.